It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. There's a lot of hand-wringing about the cost of higher education in this country, and here in California, some violent protests. One entrepreneur is experimenting with a university that is completely free. The University of the People is 100% online. NPR's Larry Abramson has this report.
Judy Kakazu is a paramedic outside Honolulu. She's a busy single mom who wants to boost her computer skills so she can work at home one day. Right now, she can't afford to go to a traditional university.
I'm in a situation where tuition would have been a problem at this point. And also time.
As we're talking, Judy Kakazu is constantly interrupted by radio chatter from the ambulance she's sitting in, waiting for her next call. She needs the flexibility that online learning would offer her. She heard about the University of the People, how else, online.
I read a little bit about it, and I thought it was just a really good cause.
The University of the People is only in its second semester. It's the bright idea of Shai Reshef, an Israeli entrepreneur who'd already been noodling with educational software. He's the chair of Cramster.com, a site that brings students together to study. His goal with the University of the People, Reshef says, was to design a school with minimal overhead.
We take whatever is there and do not invent the wheel. So online learning was there. Social networking, which we use as main component of our model, was there.
Reshef spoke to me from his base in Tel Aviv using online conferencing software, but most of his students don't have the high-speed connections needed for sophisticated online communications. Coursework is built from simple materials, mostly text. The school does have paid instructors, but Reshef says he relies heavily on social networking, on students helping each other.
Our paradigm is peer-to-peer learning combined with volunteer help and with instructor supervision and help whenever needed.
Right now, Reshef is funding the school with his own capital. The only funds he collects are an application fee and one for final exams on a sliding scale. He's looking for outside funding, and he might have to charge more if support doesn't arrive at some point. He's attracted about 380 students from 81 different countries, but he says he needs to operate on a larger scale to survive.
In order for us to be sustainable with this amount of money, we need 15,000 students.
That won't be easy. The University of the People can't offer the one thing most students want, a degree. The university is not accredited. Shai Reshef says he plans to seek accreditation, but he won't say where he hopes to get that recognition. This could be a huge challenge. There is no worldwide accrediting body. Judith Eaton of the Council on Higher Education Accreditation in Washington, D.C., says schools like this face a lot of scrutiny for a good reason.
We still have a big problem out there with questionable providers and outright degree mills. You can go to your computer and up pops buy a doctorate for $2,000 by noon today.
And that's true. I checked it out. Eaton says there's no reason why a completely online university should have any trouble getting accredited, but it will take many years. Accreditors want to explore in detail what kind of services the school is providing, she says.
Is there enough faculty time for students? Student support services. There's not a counseling office, but are there counseling services available to me whenever I need it?
But for some students at the University of the People, the degree isn't that important. Dima Sultan, 27 years old, lives in Aleppo, Syria, where she helps her family run a textile business. So she's grateful for any help she can get in developing her English and her business skills.
I want to read about business and understand how business can be expanded and be grown, how can I reflect this on my family's business and my own business in the future, for example.
Some students say this is the only option they have right now to get ahead or just to learn something new. So success for the University of the People might depend on your definition of that word. Larry Abramson, NPR News.
Public schools are increasingly disciplining students for the trouble they get into away from school. It's raising the hackles of parents who say it's their job to discipline their children for problems that occur off campus. Now a New Jersey school district is being sued for punishing students who are caught drinking at weekend parties. Nancy Solomon reports.
In 2007, two Haddonfield students died from alcohol poisoning. Then, at one Wild House party, teenagers sprayed urine across the furniture and defecated in a piano. The affluent Philadelphia suburb reacted by creating an arrangement between the police and the schools. Any student arrested for drinking or drug use would be reported to the principal and disciplined there as well.
It's simply a vigilante system of justice established by a school board in violation of the Constitution of the United States.
Matthew Wolfe is the attorney representing the parents of two 15-year-old girls who were arrested at separate parties in the last year. Their cases are still pending in juvenile court, but the school has already suspended the girls from their athletic teams and required them to do community service and undergo alcohol and drug counseling. Wolfe says the off-campus policy violates the Constitution by duplicating the punishment and meeting it out before the kids have gone to court. Also, he says drinking at a party on Saturday night has nothing to do with school safety.
If a student has stabbed another student outside of the school or stabbed anyone outside the school, we don't contend that the school doesn't have the right to exercise its authority over students who commit serious offenses.
But the case is further complicated by the punishment. Haddonfield only suspends students from extracurricular activities, athletics, student government, the school play. School Board President Steve Weinstein says that's a far cry from violating constitutional rights.
This is not a criminal proceeding. We are talking about a code of conduct, which I want to emphasize, both students and their parents sign before they begin any extracurricular activity. And they've all agreed to it.
The code of conduct specifically prohibits students from consuming alcohol or drugs away from school. On a recent afternoon, I found Justin Janowski, a 10th grader, at a coffee shop in Haddonfield. He says he doesn't like the policy and thinks parents should be the ones making decisions about how to punish their kids outside of school. But he grudgingly admits the policy is effective.
I mean, when I was a wrestler and played football, like, that's one thing I didn't want to do is get kicked off the team for, like, bad grades or, like, I don't know, get caught smoking cigarettes outside of school. So I just didn't do it. I stayed good.
Janowski attends high school in a nearby district with the same policy. In the past decade, following the Columbine shooting, schools have suspended students for all sorts of misdeeds away from campus: vandalism, minor drug possession, or cyberbullying. Courts have tended to uphold these policies as long as officials can show some connection to school safety. But beyond the legal issues, there's also rigorous debate about whether zero-tolerance policies are effective. Paul Hirschfield of Rutgers University studies and writes about the ways police and jails are increasingly used to deal with school behavior problems. He says suspensions tend to further alienate students rather than reconnect them to learning.
I see in these cases only an emphasis on suspending privileges, which is a form of punishment, rather than any emphasis on repairing any harms that the students have imposed on their schools.
Hirschfield prefers schools to take a more individual approach with discipline that encourages students to make amends and learn from their mistakes. For NPR News, I'm Nancy Solomon.
Thousands of people gathered yesterday in Selma, Alabama, to remember a day known as Bloody Sunday, 45 years ago. On March 7, 1965, state troopers armed with clubs and tear gas attacked civil rights demonstrators on Selma's Edmund Pettus Bridge. In Selma yesterday, about 10,000 people participated in a recreation of that march. Today, the Obama administration will mark the occasion a different way. Secretary of Education Arne Duncan will be in Selma today to make a major announcement. The Education Department is launching 38 investigations into possible civil rights violations by schools and colleges in over 30 states. NPR's Claudio Sanchez reports.
There's a reason the U.S. Education Department chose to unveil its civil rights agenda on the anniversary of Bloody Sunday on the Edmund Pettus Bridge, to remind Americans how much has changed for the better and what the federal government has yet to do to protect children from discrimination.
Claudio, the Office for Civil Rights is back in business.
That's Ruslan Ali, Assistant Secretary in the Office for Civil Rights. Every year, she says, her office gets about 6,300 complaints, violations that include suspending and disciplining black children more often and more harshly than other children, ignoring the needs of non-English-speaking students, and denying students access to college preparatory and advanced placement programs, just to name a few. The results, says Ali, are tragic.
African-American students are 6 times less likely to be college and career ready in biology than their white counterparts, or 4 times less likely to be college ready in algebra. We see districts where only 3% of high school English language learners are performing at grade level in math and in English.
Ali says Latinos and blacks are also more likely to get the worst, least experienced teachers. Her task?
Conduct 38 investigations around 40 different issues under our jurisdiction.
School districts and states that have been targeted may not know for weeks who they are. Education Department officials want to carefully choreograph these investigations so that they're not perceived as lowering the boom without first reaching out to school officials and getting their cooperation. How the black community views these investigations is important, too. Many black parents no longer care if their children sit next to white children, as long as they get the same educational resources and opportunities. Latinos, on the other hand, pose a very different set of civil rights challenges. Tom Sines of the Mexican American Legal Defense and Education Fund says, in some states, Latinos can't even register for school without proof of their immigration status,
which has been unlawful since 1982 in a United States Supreme Court decision.
And yet, it happens all the time, says Science. As for the desegregation of schools, Science agrees. Like most black parents, Latinos just want good teachers and safe neighborhood schools, where their children at least have a shot at catching up with their white peers.
The achievement gap is the number one civil rights issue. It's more important than integration.
That may very well be true, but Education Department lawyers say the achievement gap is the result of an opportunity gap. And that is what the department's investigations are going to tackle more vigorously than ever. Claudia Sanchez, NPR News.
Back in the late 80s, a dedicated high school teacher in East Los Angeles inspired a hit movie. Stand and Deliver was the story of Jaime Escalante, who convinced his students they could do anything with a good education. Recently, Escalante's family revealed that he's dying of cancer and that he's run out of money. So now the teacher's many admirers are standing up and delivering for him. NPR's Karen Grigsby Bates reports.
Come on, Bulldogs!
The light drizzle on a recent afternoon didn't dampen the enthusiasm of Garfield's cheerleaders. They shook their pom-poms on the street in front of Garfield High and encouraged passersby and drivers to drop donations in buckets held by students dressed as Bulldogs, their school's mascot. From the early 80s through 1991, Bolivian-born Jaime Escalante successfully taught calculus and other advanced math classes at Garfield to Latino kids who were routinely written off by society. Mark Baca says by teaching students like him the rigorous discipline,
he changed the minds of people all over the world about barrio kids. But we love Kimo because he was our mentor, he was our teacher, he was our friend, and he motivated us to believe in ourselves.
And the barrio kids who mastered algebra, geometry, trigonometry, and calculus under Escalante have come back to show their gratitude. Lawyer Araceli Lerma reels off a partial list of schools that accepted Escalante students from her 1991 graduating class.
My classmates, folks went to Harvard, Stanford, Dartmouth, MIT, Wellesley.
Escalante's story was immortalized in the motion picture Stand and Deliver. Edward James Olmos earned an Oscar nomination for his portrayal of Escalante, and the two have remained close ever since. Now Olmos is spearheading the effort to help his friend in the final stages of Escalante's illness. Olmos says it's the least they can do for the teacher his kids affectionately nicknamed Kimo, short for Kimo Sabe, he who knows.
To say thank you to someone while they're alive is the best way of communicating your love for them.
What Kimo did for his kids, Olmos says, is hard for people who don't come from here to fully appreciate.
He started off in a very small inner city school, showed the entire country that these kids that were from intensely difficult environments were capable of handling what he called a great equalizer, which was mathematics.
Math, Escalante believes, is the portal to understanding almost everything else. If you can figure out the patterns, the logic of math, you can do anything. Lorisandra Munoz says Kimo ignored labels and classifications like gifted and honors.
The thing about Mr. Escalante is he didn't care whether or not you were designated in the gifted and talented program. He gave opportunities to everybody.
And as this clip from Stand and Deliver shows, he expected them to work for it, even when other kids got time off.
Saturdays? You gotta come on Saturdays? And no vacations?
Yep, pass the AP exam and you get college credit.
What it took was ganas, the desire, the will to do the work. In a comfortable house in the town of Whittier, classmates Dolores Arredondo and Alicia Barrera are leafing through their Garfield yearbook.
It's embarrassing, right? All that hair in the 80s.
Barrera reads Escalante's inscription.
Remember, you are the best. Love, Jaime, stand and deliver.
Barrera says that was Kimo's mantra to his students. Work hard, then work harder. You can do this because you are the best. Which doesn't mean it'll be simple, he told their class when he spoke at their 1991 graduation.
You must be ready to work harder than you ever worked before.
And once we went to college, math wasn't as hard. You know, most of the classes weren't as bad as, because they didn't require as much as what he had required from us.
Barrera's classmate, Dolores Arredondo, is a vice president at one of California's largest banks. She becomes visibly emotional about Escalante's legacy.
He brought so much pride to the school, to the neighborhood. He even, I think, elevated the standards that other teachers had for themselves.
She's eager to help the man who she says changed their lives.
That's why I think we all feel this sense of responsibility, not just to him, but to his family, because they shared him with us, and now we got to give back to them.
And they will. Escalante's former students have the ganas to see that their beloved mentor gets the support he needs. Karen Grigsby-Bates, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.